Okay, so why don't we get started? I have a sign-up sheet here. I'm going to pass this around. There seem to be some students who have registered but aren't coming here, and I need to know who they are because course is at capacity and I'm still getting requests. Okay, just put your name down, and if you're here, you don't have to worry. People who aren't here have to figure out whether they want to take this class. Okay.
I have a question about
that.
Can I find the slides for the course?
Where to find the slides for the class? They are on the web page. I can, let me just show you. You can see that the slides for this class and the previous ones are already there. So if you just go, I forgot to put a link from my homepage, but I will. But this is the course URL that I mentioned last time, and I keep posting all the slides there. The lecture audio from last class is also on there. Okay, so today we are going to start chapter 2 of the book. Okay, so the quick introduction that I gave last time was material from the first chapter of the book, and today is where we actually start talking about distributed systems. And this chapter gives a broad overview of the various architectures that are in use for designing distributed systems. Okay, so we will look at centralized, decentralized, hybrid architectures. We'll look at some middleware and self-managing systems. These are just various ways to design distributed systems, and there are different dimensions, and these are point solutions in those space. Okay. So architectural styles for designing the systems, what we are going to do is look at four today. Layered architectures, which I'll talk in a moment, object-based, event-based, and data-centric architectures. Okay, so let's start with the layered one. This should be fairly simple. This is more of a design philosophy than really an architecture. Okay, but it's nevertheless something to consider. So what happens in a layered design is that the software components are organized in a sequence of layers, okay, as is shown in this picture, and each layer exposes certain functionality to the layer above it, and it uses the functionality that is provided by the layer below it in order to implement this functionality. Okay? And then what happens is then that layer exposes some other functionality and so on. The most common example of this is a protocol stack, as some of you or most of you should already know. Any protocol stack that you see in practice, including the TCP/IP stack, is based on this organization. And you will know that in that protocol stack there are a number of layers. Each layer provides certain functionality. Same principles apply to overall system design as well. And you could design your system in this way, where you have organized your architecture in a number of layers. And the lowest layer implements the most basic functionality, and you keep building on top of this. Okay? So very simple architecture. The next one is object-based architecture, and this derives its name from object-oriented programming as well, as you probably have guessed. So what happens here is that you organize your system or your distributed application into a number of objects. Okay, each object may be one or more classes in your implementation, but that is that's separate. So what we call a component in the system is an object. Each object has certain data, and it exposes some methods, which we will call its APIs. Okay? And objects can communicate with one another by invoking the methods that are exposed by the other object. So in this case, this object can invoke a method here. Okay? And that would basically look like an RPC call, and that would trigger some computation in this object, and a response would be sent back. This is how objects would communicate with one another. Now, typical Java programs use the same architecture, except that in all of the objects reside in one process on one address space. Okay? In a distributed system, these objects may not be part of one process. They may not even reside on the same machine. Okay? So different objects may reside on different machines, and yet they are able to invoke methods from one another. Okay. And to do this, you have to use either remote procedure calls or remote method invocation, RMIs, to do this. Okay. And so it's the same philosophy, except that the objects are now distributed in nature. Okay. Now this, as we'll see, is popular in client-server systems, which we will come to in a moment. Yes.
As we talk about the layered design for designing a distributed system, do the layers have to be oblivious of the fact that they are in a distributed system? Or, I mean, for instance, TCP/IP, the layers probably don't know that they're on a distributed system.
Right. So now in TCP/IP, the entire protocol stack would be part of one machine. Okay. It's just that the protocol stack is replicated on each machine where communication happens. But your question is, if you have an application organized in this fashion, how does this work, right? So in this case, the layers may themselves reside on different machines, or some subset of layers may reside on some machine. And these arrows, the communication that we see, has to go across machines. Okay? That's how it would work. So you would, that's how you would design your application. Okay, so event-based architecture is next. And here what happens is, what should be apparent by now is that in any distributed system or distributed application, there are components, and components communicate with one another. Okay. Now, in an event-based architecture, we use the notion of an event for communication. In other words, components are going to use this notion of event for communication, and there is something called an event bus, which allows or which enables this communication. Okay, so think of this as also what is referred to as publish subscribe paradigm. Okay, so your application is partitioned into components. Okay, each component can publish events saying such and such things have happened. Okay, and other components may subscribe to events saying, I'm interested, if there's an event of type foo, notify me. Okay, so you would specify your preferences to the system. And whenever any component would publish that type of event, that event would be delivered to you. Okay? So this allows the components to communicate using this notion of publish and subscribe paradigm. So consumers of events, in this case, would subscribe to types of events. Okay? And whenever those events occur, then the event bus would deliver those events to them. Okay? So this is how you would design basically a publish subscribe paradigm based system, and we'll come back to real applications of these architectures down the road. Okay, and yet another architecture that is also popular is called shared data space model. Okay, so the best way to understand this is to think of a bulletin board where you can go and post a note or a notice. Okay. So you can go and post some information on a bulletin board, and someone else can at some later point in time come and look at that bulletin board and get information from it. Okay? Same is true here. The notion of a bulletin board is basically implemented as a shared data space. Okay? This is just some blob where you can exchange data. Okay? Now any component can publish events, and they would then go and reside in the bulletin board, or in this case the shared data space. And at some later point in time, some other component can go and query the shared data space saying, do you have any events of this type? Meaning, so suppose in the going back to the bulletin board analogy, suppose that you're looking to buy a certain item and people have posted notices saying we are willing to sell this item. Okay? So you would go and look for a note of the type that interests you. And if you find one that matches, then you get that information. The same is true here. You would basically query for events of type that interest you, and if they are present in the bulletin board, they would be delivered to you. Okay. Now what is interesting here is this is also called a referentially decoupled architecture. In other words, the components are interacting, yet they are decoupled in space and time. Okay. So you are communicating with one another, but not synchronously. This is a very loose asynchronous communication. An event is published and it resides in the bulletin board. At some later point in time, some other component may take delivery of that event, and this is how communication has been enabled between these two components. In some of the previous architectures that we talked about, the implicit assumption was that communication was synchronous, which means any two interacting components both have to be communicating at the same time. Okay? In this case, it's decoupled. So that's something to keep in mind. And we'll come back to this architecture towards the very end of this course when we talk about middleware. Okay, we'll not talk about it in the interim, but it's nevertheless an interesting architecture to think about. Okay. Okay. Now, Genie and Java spaces are a good example, if you know about Genie at all. That's an example of a shared data space model. Okay, yes, Divish. Okay. Question is, in event-based communication, rather event-based architecture, rather, is this synchronous or asynchronous? It could be either one. Okay, so you could have either synchronous event communication or asynchronous. Typically, they tend to be asynchronous, but there's nothing in the architecture that precludes synchronous. Okay. Now we'll come to some other architectures that you probably are familiar with, and the client-server one is the most common way of building distributed systems. And as you probably know, what happens here is there are two types of common entities: a client, which invokes services, and those services are provided by a server. Okay. And here is an example of a typical communication between a client-server type system, which is also referred to as the request-reply paradigm. Okay. So client sends a request, and it is waiting for a response, and then the server is going to provide some service. It's going to process that request and produce a response and send that reply. Okay. Until this point in time, the client is blocked. It's waiting for a reply. Okay. And once it receives the reply, it is then going to continue execution. So the dark lines indicate that component is executing, and the dotted line indicate it is not. Okay. So that's how typical client-server communication happens, which means that you are blocking requests and you wait for a reply. Okay. Now the interesting question for us is, how are we going to partition the functionality of your distributed application between the client and the server? What is going to reside at the client and what is going to reside at the server? Okay. So any distributed application that we care about would probably have three things. Okay. One is the user interaction, which we'll encapsulate in the user interface. Okay. And then there is some computation and processing that the application is going to do. And then there is some data access that is going to take place. Okay, there is going to be some data that this distributed application has. Any request is going to trigger some computation and some accesses to the data that's stored in your application. So there are these three things: the user interface, the processing, and the data. Okay, the question is, what happens where? Okay, to understand this, we'll take a couple of examples. Okay, let's take a search engine as an example of a distributed system. Okay. Google or any other search engine would do. So this picture shows how a typical architecture, or what a typical architecture of a search engine looks like. The very top is the user interface. Okay. This typically is your browser-based interface, where you just bring up Google or some other search engine, you get a search box. Okay. So you type a query and you do send, and that is going to now be sent out by a browser to the search engine. And the search engine receives this this list of keywords. It has to translate that into a set of queries. Okay. Now it is assumed that the search engine has already crawled, let's assume this is a web-based search engine, in which case it's indexing web pages. So we assume that you already crawled the web and generated a bunch of or gotten a bunch of queries, or rather web pages, you know, indexed them and stored in a database. So your keyword query comes in, it generates, the query generator is going to then translate that to a SQL query. It's going to go to the database, which is where all the web pages are indexed. Okay, and then some results are returned. Okay. And then there's a ranking algorithm that says, based on the query or the keywords that were sent, which of these results are most relevant to the user query. Okay. So the ranking algorithm, all it is doing is ordering the results, okay, based on relevance. And then those results are handed to an HTML generator, which is going to generate a web page containing those results, and then those web pages sent back to the browser. Okay, so this is how a web search engine works. But what is more important from our perspective is not the internals of a web engine, but how the distribution of these functionality has happened. So the dotted line shows the boundary between the user level, the processing, and the data. Okay. So the data resides here. This is where all the processing happens. That's the user interface. Now, as you can see, the user interface resides at the client in this client-server architecture, and everything below this is the server. Okay, so the server has the processing and the data, and the client has the user interface. This is very common because the client is the one where users sit. Most of the user interface part of the application resides at the client, In this case, it's the browser, or what the page in the browser. The rest of the two levels are at the server. Okay. Now, this organization is also referred to as tiering. Okay, in the literature, and many people call this what is also referred as a multi-tier architecture. Okay. So, in a multi-tier architecture, what happens is the client implements either all of part of the user interface and the server implements the rest. But the server itself is not one large piece of software. It itself has components or tiers, as is shown here. In this case, there are these components. They are referred to as tiers, and tiers interact with one another to generate a response to a user request. Okay. So I'll provide some more examples here. Now, depending on how you design your application, your distributed application, in this case it was a search engine, you have a spectrum of choices. And basically the choice boils down to where is the boundary between the client and the server. So the dotted line here, okay, so these are various choices in how you would design your system. The dotted line is effectively the client-server boundary. Everything above the dotted line is what resides at the client, and everything below is what resides at the server. The example we saw in the previous case was essentially this, okay, where there is a browser is the only part at the client. There is a small user interface component at the server. In this case, that was the HTML generator. Okay, that was the thing that generated the web page and sent it back. Okay, and the application and the database, you know, were all both at the server. Okay, another organization is where the entire user interface is here, and the application and the database. And then you have various choices. Part of the application resides here, and part of the application resides here. Okay. If you think about web-based email, okay, Google Mail, the way since some of the code is actually embedded in the JavaScript that is part of the web page, okay, part of the application is now moved to the browser. Okay, it's not no longer a simple search box, but there is some processing that your browser is doing. You can do some local action without any server intervention. You can check mail or tag it and so on. Okay. So that has basically moved the boundary down where some application resides here. Now you could also have yet another organization where the user interface and the entire application is at the client end, and the only thing at the server is a database. Okay. In this case, this is what's called as a fat client, where all of the application logic is now at the client end as opposed to the server. The server only stores the data. Okay. And the last one in the list is where part of the data is also at the client. And in most cases, this would be a cache of the database. The database would typically still reside at the server, but you may cache frequently accessed data at the client end for faster access. Okay. Now, if you think about mail, not a web mail client, but a regular mail client, you probably have this organization where this database is effectively your mail server, which stores all of your messages. Okay? Your mail client may cache those messages locally on your machine, so part of the data is also here, and your application is entirely a local client, and so is the user interface. Okay, so all of the processing is done here. Only thing the thing is doing is accessing data from the server to get any new mail that you may have received to send me. Okay, so you have the spectrum of choices in how you design your distributed application, and as we will see in this class, there's no one thing that's good or bad. It depends on the context. What are you designing? What performance do you want? And that's how you will design the system appropriately. Questions here?
So any example of A, where the user interface is put at the client?
Yeah, so A is effectively something like this, right? Because there's an HTML generator, so it's part of the user interface. Not really a user interface, but it's generating at least how the page looks like. And all the browser is doing is rendering the page. Okay, so it's a loose example, but that's one way to think about it. Other questions? Okay. So this brings us to what is a very common architecture in web-based distributed application, which is referred to as a three-tier architecture. Okay, so what happens here, which is the same similar example as the search engine, but now in a more abstract setting. Okay, user interface, basically you send a request. Request comes to what's called the application server. This is where the application logic resides. Okay, that there's some processing that happens there. The application logic may require some data access, in which case it would then send a request to the database, and then that's a query. So the database does some query processing, results some query, returns some query results. Okay, and then the application logic takes those query results, does some more processing, and generates a result that is now sent to the server. Okay, the search engine example easily maps here. Okay, this is the initial keyword that was sent. You do this processing to figure out what SQL query to generate. Send off the SQL query. The database does query processing, sends back query results. Here is where you do the relevance ranking. Okay, you re-rank or reorder the results, generate the HTML, send it back, and then the user is going to look at the results on the web page. Okay. Same example is true in any web-based store that you see. Okay, if you are buying off the web, let's say Amazon and so on, the same architecture holds. You may basically send off a query to search for a catalog entry, then there is some processing, you get some results from the catalog, you may re-rank it, send it back, and this will repeat. You may then decide to buy something, okay, based on what you've seen. So then you would send a buy request, and then you would do some processing, and then the request that's sent to a database is to place an order, because you just decided to buy. So you will do some transaction processing, you may do some credit card authentication and so on, send back a result saying either it worked or not. And there may be multiple iterations of this, not one request. So you put something in a cart and that triggers one chain of this, then you say buy, it triggers another chain, then you may enter order information, shipping information, and yet another request and response have to be sent. Okay? But that's sort of what it says is, this is a very common way most web-based distributed applications are designed. And in this case, the three tiers are the HTTP tier, which does the basic HTTP or web processing. There's a J2E tier. This assumes that the application is actually written in Java, specifically using J2E servers. Okay, this is, stands for Java Enterprise Edition. Okay, and that's where the application resides, and the database is any database you can think of, Oracle or MySQL, PostgreSQL. So these are the three tiers that you see, which are very common in web-based applications. Okay? Questions? Yes.
And then looks like the trend of evolution was that we are moving from D towards A. And now it looks like again we are going towards from A to more like say something like C, where like today's browsers actually have support something like Ajax. That means some portion of the technology and application logic sits on the browser and some is at the server.
Right.
So are we going back really towards D and E, or as applications are evolving?
Right. So question is, what are sort of over time, how has this evolved and so on, right? So now it should be kept in mind, this is not a time chart, this is just a way to design your system. It is true that before the web, you would basically have some remote database and your application would probably look like either D or E, where you had a fat client, okay, that you install on your local machine and the database resides somewhere else. Okay, with the web-based applications becoming popular, the balance has shifted here. That doesn't mean that those set of applications have gone away. Okay, if you just take mail, a web mail or using mail client, both are in use. And probably most of you use one or the other or both, depending on which mail account you're accessing. Okay. But web-based applications, or it's fair to say web-based application resides towards the left, my left, and then the sort of the older applications reside towards the right. But now, since more applications shifted towards the left, this also requires network connectivity. If the network is down, then you cannot access the application, right? So you are again shifting back towards the right. So if you have web-based application and that's your only mail, right? So if you are basically, you don't have network connection, you can't access your mail. Okay? So what web-based email systems are evolving to is also something that goes back to sort of either D or E, where you can store most of the data locally. You can take a cached version of your web messages and so on. Okay, there are some web-based toolkits that allow you to do that, so that even when you're in offline mode, you have access to your web mail. Doesn't mean you always have to have network connected. So the balance keeps shifting depending on what the application is, what the users want, what the environment is, good network connectivity, not good, and so on. Okay. So that's basically the way to think about it. That is, by no means this is time-based, but that's what you said is somehow how applications are evolved. Okay, so that is three-tier application. And now I'll talk about two different architectures that look very different from the client-server model, and these are peer-to-peer architecture. Okay, so the thing that is different in a peer-to-peer architecture is that no node is more distinguished than the other. The client-server architecture, servers are more capable than the clients, and this is why servers do more work than the clients. Okay, and that's why they're providing the service and clients are merely accessing the service. In a peer-to-peer architecture, all nodes are equal. Any node can be a client or a server, depending on what it is doing at that point in time. And any node can provide any service to other nodes. Okay, that's what a definition of a P2P or a peer-to-peer architecture. Very distinct from client-server. Assume all nodes are identical. Any node can be a server or a client at any point in time. Now I'll talk about two or three different peer-to-peer architectures. Okay, so not all peer-to-peer systems are identical. They differ depending on how they are designed. And so there are two classes we'll talk about. One is what is referred to as a structured P2P architecture, and the other one is unstructured. Okay. So the first structured one we are going to talk about is what is called CORD. Okay, so here what you have is a structured system where nodes are in a logical ring. Okay. To understand this, let's try to understand what a peer-to-peer application is doing. Okay. So typical P2P applications, what they do is they are repositories of data. Okay. In a file sharing application, the data is a file. Okay. What the file is, we don't care, but it is a file, and there has to be a way to access the file. Okay. So each file has a unique key, and that key allows you to figure out where the file is. So in CORD, what happens is we assume that there can be n items. Okay? N could be very large, doesn't matter what n is. So it could be 64-bit key, in which case you can have 2 to the power 64 item. So items are numbered in your peer-to-peer system from 1 to n. Okay? Now if there were n items and n nodes, the design of the system is very simple. You just number all the items from 1 to n, you number all the nodes from 1 to n. And node I is responsible for item I. Okay? If you want to access data item I, you just simply go to node I. Okay? Now that's also shown in this ring, not really shown in this ring, but assume that in this case, all of your items go from 0 to 15. Okay? And if there were 15 nodes, then each node would store one item. Okay? And the item that it stores is the same as its own ID. Now, typically in any peer-to-peer system, the number of items is going to be much greater than the number of nodes. Okay, in a file-sharing system, you have far more files than peers, just as an example. So, to design the system, you now have to come up with a way to group items so that a node now not only becomes responsible for one item, but some group of items. Okay, and that is what CORD does. In CORD, what happens simply is any node is responsible for all items that have an ID less than or equal to it until the previous node. So nodes are arranged in a logical ring, okay? And nodes are machines in this case. Okay? So here anything that is a dark circle is a node or is a machine that is participating in this P2P network. Whenever you join the network, you pick an ID that no one else has. Okay? This ID goes from 0 to n, and you join the logical ring at that point in the ring. Okay. So in this case, this node decided to pick an ID 4, so it joined the ring at that location. Okay. Now if you pick this ID, you are responsible for all data items with an ID less than or equal to yours. So in this case, this node is responsible for data items with keys 2, 3, and 4. Okay. And then this node is responsible for 0 and 1. This node is responsible for 5, 6, and 7. So if a new node joins, let's say a node joins and it decides to pick 9, then this 12 has to hand over responsibility for data items 8 and 9 to that node. Okay, and when you leave, you hand over responsibility to your neighbor. Okay, so this is a logical ring. So you have two neighbors, your left neighbor and yes.
What happens when your data comes in?
Okay, so I haven't talked about all of that, just one second. So question is what happens when the data comes in? So we'll come to that in just a moment. Okay, so this is basically the architecture. Now, we'll first, before we talk about even data, let's see how you can search for items. Okay, so you want to access an item from this peer-to-peer system. Okay, you have to first figure out a key. How do you find the key? Let's not worry about it. So it could be just a file name that is hashes to a number. Okay, that's the key for that data item. So you find the key, and then you go to the current live node that has the ID that's strictly greater than that key. Okay, so if you want to look for data item 3, your query has to go to 4, because that's the first node that has an item that's an ID that's greater than or equal to the item you're responsible for. And that node is then going to tell you where that item resides. Okay, is this clear? So this is basically a directory mapping, or each node stores a table of node of the keys as well as locations of those data items. Okay, so I have implicitly assumed that although in this case, let's say 4 is responsible for 2, 3, and 4, that responsibility doesn't mean that 4 has to necessarily store 2, 3, and 4. It just has to store the locations of 2, 3, and 4. It just has to say where in the peer-to-peer system do these items reside. Now, these items could reside at this node itself, but they could reside anywhere else. This is just trying to keep track of where in your system the items that you are interested in are present. Okay? Now you ask the question, what happens when the data comes in, right? So that was the question. So if you want to add a data, so assumption is you have a very large key space. So whenever you want to add an item, it has to map to some key. Okay? And depending on what that key is, some node in the system is going to be responsible for tracking that item in the system. Okay? There may be multiple copies of that item, because if you download a P2P object and you want to share it, there are multiple replicas. And then the node responsible for that is going to keep track of that information, saying this object 8 is available in 6 locations, and these are the 6 locations. Okay? So that's how it works. Okay, now this is called, and before I move on, yes, there are questions. Okay. So I glossed over a lot of details here. Question is, whenever a new node comes in, how does it know who its neighbors are, right? So there has to be a discovery mechanism. It tells it who your neighbors are and so on. The discovery mechanism is part of the protocol. Different protocols would have different discovery mechanism. So you could flood saying, I have picked this ID for myself. If your ID is close to mine, respond to me. Okay, so you could do that. You could do a search. So suppose you pick 9, you can do a search saying, is there a node with ID 8 currently? Is there a node with 7? And then 7 would respond, right? So you could do a variety of things. Is that clear? Yes.
ID selection is random. It might so happen that one node may be responsible for a lot of data, and some nodes would be like, you know, say, example,
right.
Node say plus on the right half of the circle.
Correct. So, good question. Question is, if ID selection is random, will the ring have uniform distribution of nodes? Some nodes may have more load than other. Absolutely. This can happen. Even worse, you don't have control over how nodes join and leave the network, right? So it may so happen that 1 is there, but 4, 7, and 12 just decide to leave. Okay? Then you have to be responsible for, or rather the other way around. Let's say 12 leaves and then 7 would have to take off. Since this peer-to-peer systems are designed for dynamic setting, you cannot ensure perfect load balancing. But the assumption is when there are a lot of participants, since this is a randomized algorithm, things will even out. But by no means can you assume perfect load balancing, not even because of the ID selection problem, but because of joins and leaves, which you have no control over. ID selection you may be able to control, but joins and leaves you cannot control. Okay. So the next structured peer-to-peer network is what is called content addressable network, or CAN. Okay, so the idea is very similar, except that here keys are multi-dimensional. Okay. In the previous case, we assumed that keys were integers. They just went from 0 to n, a single number. So suppose that keys are not integers but are tuples. Okay, so they are basically that any object is uniquely identified by, let's say, a pair, ing. Okay, these are basically two integers. Okay, in this case, you get a two-dimensional P2P network. You could have any arbitrary dimensions. Okay, what is shown in this, I'll talk about CAN using a two-dimensional example, but the idea generalizes to D-dimensional. So again, it's the same concept. So the assumption is that in this case, let's say take a two-dimensional CAN network. You have these two dimensions, and your keys can, in this case, go from 0 to 1 along the x-axis and 0 to 1 along the y-axis. Okay, this is just an example. So you could have gone from 0 to n. Doesn't matter. Okay, so data items in this case map to coordinates, because any data item basically gets associated with a pair of integers now rather than a single integer ij. So in that case, it just becomes some coordinate in this two-dimensional space. Okay. Now, whenever a node wants to join the network, it picks a coordinate for itself. Just as in the previous case, you picked an ID and you joined the ring. It's the same thing happens here. You just pick a coordinate and you join this two-dimensional space. So all the dots here are nodes in the system that are currently live. Okay. So whenever you join at a particular coordinate. Okay, all of the data items that are in your immediate vicinity, you become responsible for. Okay, and when you leave that, basically you hand over that responsibility to someone else. Same idea, but now we are just generalizing this to two dimensions. So in this case, you have this node, its coordinates 0.2 and 0.3, and everything in this rectangle, it is responsible for. So if you want to find a data item, and it maps to a coordinate within this rectangle, you go to this node and ask for where is that item in the P2P system. Same is true here. Okay. Now, suppose there is a new node. So we have to see how joins and leaves occur. So suppose there is a new node in the system, and it picks a coordinate for itself that's somewhere here. Okay. So then what happens is this rectangle has to be split, because now this node gets some responsibility and the other node gets those. That's what is shown in this picture. Okay. So a new node joins, and that large rectangle breaks into two. So the new node now looks after this lower rectangle, and the old node looks after that one. Okay. Now joins are always easy in this system than leaves, because join can take any rectangle and you split it. Depending on where you fall, you take that rectangle and chop it up into two. Leaves are not that simple. Okay. Suppose that the node 0.6, 0.7 decides to leave. So you have to hand over all of the responsibility for this data item to one of these two nodes. Okay? Now, if you hand it to this node, that region is no longer a rectangle. And the same is true for the other node. Okay? So you get an uneven space for which you are responsible. So you have to periodically rebalance or resplit if you want to keep the region for which each node is responsible symmetric. In the sense it's a regular shape like a rectangle or a cube or something like that, you would have to rebalance. There is no other way to do it. Then what you would have to do is basically take this big rectangle and resplit by drawing a line like that, so that there are two of those. Okay? There's no other way to do it. So that is a disadvantage of this technique. When you do leaves, there is more work to be done if you want to maintain this nice structured set of responsibilities.
Let me explain. Then the point is joined to this network. You will change the other existing point.
Yes. Yes. So in this case, as you can see, this node had 0.2, 0.3. Its coordinate became 0.2 and 0.45. It's because you split the thing, so you are basically at the centroid of that rectangle. Okay. So your coordinate will change when somebody enters or leaves. Okay. So that is true. Now, the same question of how to add data items. So this is how nodes reside in the system. If you want to add a data item, you have to pick a key. And depending on what rectangle you fall in, you contact that node saying, I am a new data item. This is where I reside. Keep this directory information so that if someone is looking for this data item, this is where it resides in the system. Okay, so you have to have a directory that keeps track of all of the data items in your system, within your region. Is this clear? Yes.
What is the advantage of this approach? It seems like a pretty big drawback at
least. So what is the advantage of this approach? Well, it is the only advantage is, I mean, in some sense, you can always take a multidimensional key and construct a one-dimensional key. Okay, but there are scenarios where you might have data items that are multiple attributes. Right. So simple. So if you just have file names. Okay, let's assume file names are integers rather than strings. This is one attribute. Okay. Suppose you have file types. Okay, so you have file type saying this is an MP3, this is a JPEG image, this is a second attribute. Okay, this allows you to search on individual attributes. In the previous case, you had only one dimension, so you could only search, let's say, on the file name. But there may be two file names. Okay, one is with the same name, but one is a music file, and that's the same. It could be foo.mp3 and foo.jpg. You would get two results, whereas you could have done a better job by saying, I'm interested in file foo of this type. Okay? So you could construct better searches using this. You could also search on arbitrary dimensions, which you couldn't do in the previous case. So that's what D-dimensional system. It's the same thing as a database, right? Are you going to, what keys can you search on, right, within a table? So this allows you to search on multiple attributes. Any other question here?
Is BitTorrent a peer-to-peer system?
Okay. Question is BitTorrent a peer-to-peer system? I'm going to come to BitTorrent in just a couple of slides.
Suppose instead you have one file, it's a big file, it has some key. Now file is divided in some chunks. How you distribute them again? You will give different chunks.
Okay. So you are asking some questions that we'll come to in just a moment. So here the question is, if you have a large file and you chop it up into smaller pieces, how does it work? This doesn't care about how a file is chopped. Okay, so if there are two ways to answer the question. One is, don't partition the file. A file just has one key, and you will have some large files and some small files, and there will be imbalance, and that's the way it is. The other way to think about is, if the file is very large, you will have to partition it into smaller chunks. Okay. Each would get a key. How you pick the key is not material, but then it's the responsibility of the user to figure out that this file has multiple keys. That gets pretty tricky. Okay. So these systems are best for where you don't chop up a file. Okay. We'll come to BitTorrent where you chop up files in just a moment. Okay. So assume here that you don't do that. Okay. So the other category of peer-to-peer system, before we come to BitTorrent, are unstructured. These were actually early peer-to-peer systems where you don't have this nice structure where either the system can be thought of as a ring or a d-dimensional space. Okay? Unstructured systems also use randomized algorithms. So what happens in an unstructured peer-to-peer system is there are some set of nodes that are participating in the system. Each node basically picks k random neighbors and says, I am your neighbor. Okay, so then you think of the peer-to-peer system as an overlay network. You basically draw logical links to your neighbors. Okay, so in this case, we just have a picture here. So let's assume that there are some number of nodes. Okay. Whenever a node joins, it has to pick, let's say, two neighbors and just draw links to them, saying, I'm your neighbor. So in this case, this node joins and it draws links here. This node can decide to do this. So this is the structure of your network. Okay, now new node joins, it just picks two of these nodes at random, and then it just joins the network by becoming their neighbors. Okay, this is an overlay network, as you can imagine. But that's how the network keeps growing. Okay, and when nodes leave, then those links are dropped. Okay, now Gnutella was an example of an unstructured peer-to-peer system. That's how Gnutella works. It basically, you have nodes, they just pick k neighbors at random, and you get some topology. Now, in unstructured peer-to-peer system, what is interesting is that there is no notion of keys that we were talking about in structured peer-to-peer system. You can search for objects, but typically use flooding. Okay? So suppose you want to basically find a file with name foo. Okay? There is no one node that is going to be responsible for this. Unlike in structured peer-to-peer system, this would then map to a unique node. Okay, that is well defined. There's a function that we are defining that says who is responsible for this. The unstructured system, that's not the case. Any arbitrary node may have this. So the only way to look for items is to flood. So then you would basically send search queries along all your links saying, do you have foo? Okay, so this message would appear here. And then if it has it, you will send back a response. If not, you will flood. So you would basically send that message this way. And this foo message appears here. If this node has foo, it sends a response. Otherwise, it will continue flooding until either all the nodes in the network have received this query, or some substantial subset. Okay? So search is based on flooding in most unstructured peer-to-peer systems. In the previous case, you could basically do use a function that tells you who is responsible for this and that. You just go to that node and says who has this object, and it will tell you. Okay. So that's unstructured. Now, although the two look very different, okay, in how they are constructed, if in the book there is actually a nice insight which is drawn from a paper, which says that if you can take any unstructured peer-to-peer system, there's an algorithm that can turn it into a structured system, or vice versa. Okay, so the way to think about it is you have some, let's take an unstructured peer-to-peer system as is shown here. Okay. There are some arbitrary links that are present in this unstructured system. Okay. So what this algorithm does, with the algorithm that will convert this into a structured network, is that it will take these links and it will just swap some of the edges around in this graph. And I'll not go into how to swap it. That's described in the paper. I just want to give the high in the book. I'll just present the high-level idea. So you just take some links and say I'm going to replace this link with some other link. And if you do this some number of times, your the structure of the network or the topology of the network goes from unstructured to structured. Okay? So as is shown in this picture. Okay, so here in an unstructured network where there are some arbitrary links. So then you basically take that algorithm and you just start swapping some links around. If you do this iteratively k times, your network starts looking like a torus, okay? Meaning that the topology of the nodes basically resemble a torus, which is a structured peer-to-peer network, because there's some structure to that network, whereas this is more of a random network where edges can go from any node to any other node. Okay? So all this is saying is that the two are not as different as one might think. There is a very well-defined algorithm that can turn one to the other, okay, just by exchanging some edges in the graph. Okay, so it's just turning you think of this as a graph. You're just turning an unstructured graph, which has random links, to a structured graph. Okay, that's all that this algorithm does. But I'll not dwell on this anymore. Instead, let me talk about some other designs for peer-to-peer systems. Now, so in a traditional or a pure peer-to-peer system, all peers are identical. No node is more distinguished than the other. Okay? And that's how many of these systems work. But for many... Yes, your question.
I have a question. So in a peer-to-peer system, when a new node joins, then how does it know the IP address?
Okay, so in a peer-to-peer system, when a new node joins, how does it know the IP address of someone else, right? No, so you don't. So question is, do you need to know IP addresses of all the nodes? You don't have to do that. What the protocol allows you to do is it allows you some entry points into the network. And once you get into the entry points, you can run discovery protocols to figure out who is present in the network, and that also tells you what their IP addresses are. So no, since these are highly dynamic networks, you cannot assume that there is something that you know ahead of time. Everything is basically discovery based. Okay, so you can either flood the network and discover this information, or there is at least some number of well-known entry points, and you use those entry points to enter the network and then discover it. So, but you don't assume that you know any IP addresses. Not flood the internet. When I said the network. Right. So you need to know some entry points, which are, let's say, some nodes where the lifetime of those nodes is very high. They will not leave the network. If you have some of those nodes, you can, and you know some of them, you can use those nodes to enter the network, which means you send a query saying, what are some nodes close to me? Okay? So this entry point may be, let's say, on a node on that's far away from you. So you don't want that node to be your neighbor, but that node allows you to send a query into the network. And then you discover nodes closer to you by discovery protocols.
So if you have B2B
systems, you ask nodes, are in some way distinguished from the... Yeah, only from the perspective of initial joining, right? When you come up, if you know nothing about where a node is, there's no way you're going to join the system other than to flood your entire network, and that's not a good way to do it. So you assume that there will be some peers who will have long lifetime. So these could be peers that may be the organization that built the network or something like that. Or you could, there are other techniques, like you could just do DNS lookups, right? So So let's suppose that you want to, this is just some another way to do it. So suppose you do foo dot, I'll just pick some dotella.net. Okay. So you may not know IP address, but you may know that when you come up, I am going to just do a DNS lookup on foo.nutella.net. Okay. Now, what happens in the background is, in the network, some node is just becomes responsible for answering to this DNS, and you just go and update the DNS entry in this case. Okay. So when some new node wants to join, it just does a DNS lookup. It will get an IP address of some node that is currently live. Okay. So in this case, nodes don't even have to be live for long periods of time. You are just using DNS to get into the network. So there are all sorts of tricks people have come up with. And if that node leaves, then some other node has to become responsible for answering this, which means you will do frequent DNS updates. But that's the price you will pay for the dynamics of the network. Okay. Or you will have to hard code at least some entry points into the network. Once you know one node, you can figure out, or some small subset of nodes, you can figure other things out. But you need that initial entry point. Any other questions? Okay, super peers. So that actually brings us to this topic of super peers, which is precisely what some of these nodes do. So in a traditional pure peer-to-peer system, all nodes are identical. No node is more distinguished than the other. But to provide some useful services, it is always useful to have some more distinguished nodes. Okay, and that is what super peers do. Okay. So some nodes become more distinguished and they take responsibility. So this could be a super peer basically becomes responsible for all nodes in its region and it keeps track of who is joining and leaving. Okay. So rather than flooding, you just go and ask the super peer, how many nodes do you have in your vicinity, what are their addresses? And this node is keeping track of them, so you don't have to flood. Or it is providing other useful services about these nodes. Okay. So what we have done effectively is we have elevated some of the more stable nodes in your peer-to-peer network and given them more responsibility. Okay, because they are stable and they may be more capable at the same time, if you give them more responsibilities, you get a better service. Okay. Now, this notion of super peer is used both in file sharing P2P systems as well as other types of P2P systems like Skype. Okay, if you use Skype, which is not a file sharing network at all, it uses the notion of super peers. And in Skype, what super peers do is they keep track of who is logged in. Okay, so you have your buddy list in Skype. When you log into Skype, it tells you who are all the users that are logged in. Okay. Now, Skype doesn't make any assumption that you always log in from the same machine. You can walk to any arbitrary Skype machine, start Skype, enter your username, and you're logged in from that. Right? So somehow the network has to discover all of this. Yeah, because it has to know who is logged in, where are you logged in from, and super peers are given that responsibility. So they'll keep track of who is where and how do you, if you want to initiate a Skype call to someone else, which IP address you should contact, and all of this the super peers do. Now clearly this is more responsibility, so you have to be more stable, because if you just decide to leave the network, all of that information disappears. Okay, so you want to be more stable and you have to be more capable. You have to have good network bandwidth because more traffic will be directed to you than some other arbitrary peer. Okay. So if you actually use Skype and you probably, if you have actually gone and mugged around with your machine, you may suddenly discover that you have become a super peer because Skype just decided that your machine has a lot of bandwidth or is capable and just elevated you to super peer and you start getting more random requests even though nobody may be calling you at that point in time, but you are answering queries for other Skype users who are trying to track down other users in the network. Okay. And so on. So in a file sharing network, super peers may actually hold directories of what is on all of these and may answer queries themselves instead of flooding the network. Okay. Now it's not assumed that a super peer is always going to be on. Okay. Super peers can also leave, which means that you have to be careful when you elevate a node to a super peer. You want it to provide that service for some reasonable period of time. Because if the super peer leaves, you have to rediscover all of the information that disappeared with it. Okay? So that's the notion of a super peer. Now, this is again, as you can see, in a P2P, no node was more distinguished than the other. Here, you are beginning to resemble a client-server architecture again. right? So because these nodes are more capable, so they are taking on the responsibility of providing more services than the typical. Okay, but it's not, by no means has it become a traditional client server, but it has some of those ideas back into the P2P systems. So yet another architecture is what is called an edge server system. Now we have moved away from P2P, we are back in client server world. Okay, but this is basically yet another way to construct large distributed system. So what edge servers do is basically it changes the architecture of your system from a client server to a client proxy server. Okay, if you think of an edge server as a proxy, okay, so this becomes a client proxy server. So there are three entities in your system now: a client, which is what the old client was; a server, which is exactly what the old server did; but there's a new entity which we'll call an edge server or a proxy, which takes on some responsibility from the server, but not all. Okay? And the assumption is that the edge server, in this case, where is it? Okay, it's right here. So here is your client. Okay, this is the ISP. Let's say it's your cable network provider or a dial-up ISP. And those are your clients. Okay? This is where your web server is. Okay? And the assumption is typically the servers are going to be far from the clients. Okay, if you basically look at a random web server, let's say CNN, CNN may be hosted in Atlanta or on the West Coast. So you have to basically traverse some network distance in order to fetch the content. So clients are typically far off from servers in the context of the web, at least. Okay. So what edge servers do is they bring some of the services that are provided by remote servers somewhere closer to the client. Okay, in this case, this edge server may be closer. It may be a node that is local to your ISP, and the edge server, very simple service it could provide is web caching. It may just cache web pages that are actually provided by the remote server. So when you try to access the page, you get it from a server that's close to you as opposed to going to a far off server. So you get better performance. In this case, you get better response time. Okay. So that is basically what edge servers do. And there are entire networks that have been built called content distribution network that are just an overlay network of caches or edge servers that have been deployed on global scales. Okay. The Akamai network, if you know about Akamai, is an example of a content distribution system where there are tens of thousands of these edge servers. Practically every ISP, they have put several caches, okay, tens or hundreds of caches depending on the size of the ISP. So whenever you access, in this case, web pages, you may get it from a nearby server, so users see better performance from this system. Okay? So the basic idea of a proxy is to bring some of the services provided by the remote server closer to clients, and by doing so, you give better performance. Okay, that's the basic idea. But at the end of the day, it could be a cache, or just it may be replicating some functionality closer to clients. Okay, so that's, we'll come back to our content distribution networks when we study web caching, maybe in a couple of months from now. Is this clear? Edge servers. Okay. So now we'll come to BitTorrent, which was some of the questions that came up earlier. Now BitTorrent, although it is a form of a peer-to-peer system, it provides several interesting enhancements, which is why we didn't discuss it as a form of a peer-to-peer network. Okay. So what does BitTorrent do? So there are several interesting ideas in BitTorrent. So BitTorrent is designed for very large downloads. Okay, so if you have very large files, sort of DVD quality stuff, it could be a software DVD or something else. So downloading it from any one machine will probably take a long period of time. Okay? And since peer-to-peer networks are dynamic and the period of download time is very large, those nodes may disappear before the download completes. Okay? This used to be a standard problem in older peer-to-peer networks. If you actually shared a very large file and you started downloading it from peer, maybe you get good service for some period of time and that peer disappears. Now your file, you downloaded half the file. You have to restart that download from somewhere else. Okay? That's a problem. So what BitTorrent does, it allows you to share very large content. And the way it does this is it chops up this large content into smaller pieces called chunks. Okay. And each node is only responsible for either one or some small number of chunks, but this file is now spread across very large number, not very large, but large number of nodes, and you have to just download different pieces of the files from different nodes, and chunks are replicated. Okay, so this basically makes it simpler for you to download large content, because chunks are replicated. So if you fail to download a chunk from one node, you go to some other node that has it and get it from there, and different chunks you get from different nodes. Okay. That's the that's one idea behind BitTorrent, and I'll talk about how you go about doing this. Okay. So here is basically a client that is looking for a large file. Okay. What happens typically in BitTorrent is you have to first go to some web page. So somebody put up a web page that says this file is now available from this this location, and this is called a torrent. So there's a BitTorrent web page that is going to point you to a server. Okay. This is how you enter BitTorrent. Okay. So now this server, what it is doing, it keeps a file called a torrent. And torrent is simply an index. This says that this file has these pieces. Okay, if you want to download this file, you have to download these 10 pieces, because this file is chopped up into 10 pieces. Okay, it's an index for the file, or rather it's basically a list of all of the pieces you have to download in order to reconstruct the whole file. That is all that a torrent does. Okay, so once you know which are the n pieces you need to download for the files, the next step is to discover or figure out who in the network currently has those chunks. Okay. For that, you have another entity called a tracker. Okay, so what a tracker does is simply it keeps track of, for every chunk that the torrent refers to, it keeps track of who currently has that chunk in the network. Okay. So suppose that there are n nodes, or rather n chunks, the tracker rather will point you to those n nodes, saying get piece 1 from node 1 and piece 2 from node 2 and piece 3 from node 3. And then what the client would have to do is it would have to establish connections to all of those and download it. Okay. This is the very basic idea behind BitTorrent. Now there are several nice features that I'll talk about in just a moment. Okay. Is this clear before I do that? What is a torrent? What's a tracker? Now, the first thing that nice thing about BitTorrent, it allows you to do parallel or concurrent downloads, which means since the file is large and if you have to download lots of chunks, you don't download them sequentially, but you pick some subset of the chunks and start connections to those nodes and start downloading them in parallel. This will speed up your download, simply because if you have multiple TCP connections, you will get more bandwidth than maybe a single connection would give you. Why, we will not talk about here. That's a topic for the networking class. But for now, let's just assume you do parallel downloads, you'll get slightly better performance, or much better performance than one single. Okay? That's the first thing that BitTorrent does. The second thing that BitTorrent does is the notion of incentives, okay, which was not there in other peer-to-peer systems. Okay, in all of the earlier systems that we just talked about, what would happen is many peers would just be downloaders, but would never want to upload a service. In other words, you download a file, but you don't want to share it with anyone, which means that although you have a copy, okay, nobody can download it from you. Okay? So in other words, there are only a smaller number of peers that are actually offering the files than there are replicas in the system. BitTorrent, on the other hand, offers an incentive. It says that if you are not going to share, you are going to suffer. Okay, which means you have incentive to share. So in other words, how does it do this? Is that your download bandwidth is set to some fraction of your upload bandwidth. If you are currently uploading some chunks that you have on your machine to three other peers, your BitTorrent will allow you to download three chunks in return. Okay? So if you are sharing more, it allows you to download more. So this naturally gives an incentive to share, because if you don't share, it will throttle your bandwidth and not let you download. So in other words, it is encouraging users to participate in the network, okay, by sharing the content they've already downloaded. And the advantage of doing this is it allows you better to download more and get better performance. So this notion of incentive is very fundamental. It was a sort of it makes BitTorrent very successful. And this basically also says that when you download large files, providing incentives is helpful, because more users now participate in the network by allowing their chunks to be downloaded by other peers, and this benefits the network as a whole. Okay. So there are these two interesting things. There is notion of chunks and there is notion of parallel downloads. Okay. So that's what this bullet says. It's forcing altruism, which means it's encouraging you to be altruistic and let other people use your resources, not that you just load up on other people's resources. Okay, and then it has this, if you see queue download, then you reduce the sampling rate. Okay, so you're basically balancing for upload and downloads accordingly. Okay. Any questions here? Is this clear? Not BitTorrent. Okay. So the last thing here, and we have maybe 5 minutes to talk about this, is the notion of self-managing systems. Okay, this is yet another architecture, the last one that we will talk about here. And what the self-managing distributed systems do is that they are adaptive in nature. Okay? The assumption is that the system has a lot of dynamics, okay, of various sort. Loads may change, the number of users may change, and so on. And if you want to continue to provide good overall performance, the system needs to adapt itself to the workload and the environment as both of these change over time. Okay? So, in other words, the system has the capability of monitoring itself, monitoring what is happening in the entire system and taking action autonomously, okay, without any human intervention. It's adapting to what's happening in the system. Okay? Now, this idea has actually spawned an entire field of research called autonomic computing or self-managing or self-star systems, okay, which we will talk about not now but later in this course. So there are several self-managing properties you may want. Self-healing systems is just one example. So what self-healing systems say is that if some entities in your distributed systems fail, others take over automatically and the system heals itself. Okay, so it's healing faults automatically without any user saying or administrator saying this thing has happened, so we are going to take that corrective action. The system is taking a corrective action on its own. Okay? A self-managing system may do automated resource allocation. If the load on the system increases, it may automatically add more capacity to the system to meet this increased load. Okay? If you don't do that, you will run out of capacity, system will saturate and user performance will suffer. Okay? So there are various dimensions along which the system can be adaptive. Okay? And this is an entire field, as I mentioned. And what I'll just talk about here is just one example of automatic capacity provisioning, the example I just mentioned, where you can vary the capacity of a web server based on demand. Okay? So one way to design your distributed system is to anticipate how much workload you are going to see when you actually put the system live and have enough capacity to service that workload. But you may not always be able to anticipate the workload well. So suppose that, just to give you an example, you have a blog, okay, and you have someone hosting the blog for you. Okay, let's suppose that you have paid hosting, which means you pay someone to host it for you as opposed to a free service. So when you pay someone, you have to decide what level of service you want. Let's suppose you have bronze service and silver service and gold service. And bronze service, just say your blog is hosted on some low-end server. And if you get gold service, your blog is hosted on some high-end, let's say, 4-core machine with 2 gig of RAM, as opposed to a uniprocessor with half a gig of RAM. Okay? So, but you have to decide what level of service you want. Now, how will you do this? You will do this based on some expectation of how many users are going to access your blog. Okay, if only your friends access it, you're okay with bronze service. Okay, but if your blog is basically linked to, let's say, CNN or New York Times, you'll get a lot of traffic to your blog, so you better have more capacity. Otherwise, people are not going to be able to view it. Okay? Now, that in this case, you're making a static decision of the capacity and the level of service you want. Okay? But you may not know ahead of time when you put up a blog, is it going to be popular or not. Maybe you want it to be popular, but it may not be. Or vice versa, you may think no, only your friends care, but a lot more people may care. Okay? Now, if you want to dynamically decide how much capacity to pick rather than statically deciding, you would basically design your system. Okay? Not you, but you would actually want your system to vary capacity to match demand. Okay? Which means that you may start with some low capacity, but if suddenly the traffic to your blog increases, the system itself adds more capacity dynamically. It may just dynamically transition your blog to a larger server, so your users are not turned away from the system. Okay? That is basically what the notion of an autonomic system is. Okay? Now, there are lots of techniques that people have designed. Okay? And that the basic idea behind this technique is sort of encapsulated in this picture, where you would monitor the workload. Okay? if the what your decision is to vary the capacity, you are going to compute the future or current demand on the system, and you're going to adjust the capacity accordingly. And this loop is going to continue. Okay? As the capacity workload increases, capacity goes up. As the workload drops, capacity goes down, and so on. Okay? Now, there are several whole bunch of techniques people have looked at. I will just talk about one and end. Okay? And the one that we'll talk about is to use what is called a feedback control model to basically implement this loop that I just talked about. And this is just to give you an idea. You don't have to understand a lot of the details here. So what this does is it is using control theory to do capacity allocation. Yeah, if you know anything about control theory, what you probably know is in a control theoretic system, there is some target and you're monitoring the system to see if the performance of the system is deviating from the target. As the deviation grows, it takes more corrective action. So there are many examples of control theoretic system, right? So the way space vehicles are operated is using control theoretic systems. If you use a thermostat in your house, that's also using a very simple feedback loop where it is looking at the temperature in the room and it's looking at what the desired temperature is. If the two begin to deviate, it will either turn the heater on or the air conditioning on. It will try to bring the actual temperature closer to the target. And when it approaches the target, it will switch off the heater or the air conditioning. Okay? The same thing is true in this system. So in a web, let's say if you use this control theoretic model to do automatic capacity provisioning, what you will do is you will set some targets. Let's suppose the target is end user response time. And you say all web requests to my blog should be serviced within 1 second. If a user has to wait more than 1 second, then I consider that to be bad service. Okay? Just as an example. So then what the system would do is it has this target of 1 second. It's going to measure what the actual response time your system is providing. Okay? If the load is low, the system probably has enough capacity, so your actual response time may be less than a second, so system doesn't do anything. But as the load goes up, the load on the system would increase and the response time would also increase. And at some point, let's say it exceeds a second because the load is very high. Okay. At that point, you see that the deviation from the target is more than your threshold and you have to take some corrective action. Okay. In the case of the thermostat, the corrective action was to turn on your heater. Okay. In this case, the corrective action is to add capacity. Okay. By adding capacity, it would just say, let's take this entire website and move it to a larger server. Okay, that just gave you more capacity. So you do this automatically. Okay, and then your system would run on a larger server and you would get more capacity. Your response time would come down again because the system has enough capacity to meet the demand and so on. Okay, so there are techniques that have been designed in quite some detail to do this. I just want to sort of give the high level idea here. Okay, we'll come back to this later on in this course. So that is where we are going to end today. Are there any questions on self-managing systems? No? Okay. So let's stop here and we will continue next time.